The following audio excerpts are taken from a presentation given by conscientious objector and former Army Reserve Specialist Adon Delgado in San Francisco on Sunday, January 30th, 2005.
The quotation comes again from my commander, whom I started with zero respect and then decreased from there. But he told us we were all assembled getting ready to go to Iraq. He got us together for one of his infamous motivational speeches. And he said, "Now don't go tell the media that you're going to go over there and kill some ragheads and burn some turbans." Ha 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 ha. And the whole unit laughed with him. And I suddenly got this feeling that this was about to be a disaster, that our commander and our supervisors were going into war with this mentality. And I had grown up in Egypt and I had many Muslim friends. And I just realized that this was about to be very, very bad. When I first came to Iraq, I spoke Arabic, so I could actually speak to Iraqis and get a sense of what they were feeling. When I first came to Iraq, it really was a sense of liberation. We were almost greeted as flowers in the streets like they had promised us, almost. The predominant thing Iraqis told me was, "God bless you, welcome, we love you, we love George Bush, down with Saddam." It really was that's true. As the occupation continued, their attitude towards us really began to sour. 6 months into the occupation, they would say, "We love you, welcome, but when are you going home?" And I would say, "Soon, I hope." By the end of my deployment, 1 year later, when I would speak to Iraqis, they would say, "When are you going home? We want you to go home." And I would reply, "I want to go home too." In the initial assault, a lot of civilians were trying to flee the combat zone, especially in the south, in Nasiriyah. A lot of families were trying to escape from the path of the 3rd Infantry Division. And I heard this directly from 3rd Infantry men who were involved in it. They set up a roadblock with scout tanks, Bradley tanks. Civilian vehicles would try and pass through and flee the city. They would come out and say, "Stop, stop, stop," in English. Obviously, they didn't understand. And they would either destroy the vehicle with the rotary cannon or crush it. So there was an enormous amount of civilian deaths caused by civilians trying to flee the war zone or being mistaken. Any white vehicle we had been briefed was considered an enemy vehicle because it was possible that Saddam had released white vehicles with bombs or something. So we were particularly on the lookout for white vehicles. The 3rd Infantry and the Marines were extremely aggressive as a unit, and generally they destroyed vehicles rather than take chances. A very wise drill sergeant once told me, "We have all these planes, we have all these bombs, we have all this sophisticated equipment, but it's all just a means to deliver you, to deliver your knife into the enemy." From the very first days of the assault, you could see the roots of inhumanity and bestial treatment of Iraqis. The way they would desecrate their bodies or mar their corpses was from the very first days. And all that continued throughout the occupation, blossomed at Abu Ghraib, and I saw it progress throughout my time in the occupation, beginning with desecrating the bodies that Iraqis killed. For the first month, we were limited to one MRE ration and one 2.5 liter bottle of water a day per person. So it was like 120 degrees outside, and we had one 2.5 liter bottle of water. So I remember when we first got into this base and we were carrying our gear inside, a friend of mine was walking, turned, vomited like a white mucus, and just collapsed unconscious from dehydration. It used to happen all the time. So he'd be working outside, turn, fall unconscious, pick him up, slap him, wake him up. We didn't have any water, and we didn't have anything to give him. So that was the situation when we first moved in. The main danger that really confronted us in the south, it wasn't so much of a hot zone in terms of combat. The main danger was unexploded ordnance that was on the base. The coalition air campaign had dropped countless bomblets and munitions all over the ground. And so it was extremely hazardous to go in areas of the base that hadn't been checked and mapped out. And I remember a surreal moment when we first got there was our command. There was a huge open field behind our base, and our command didn't know whether it was safe. So they got the 12 lowest ranking guys in the unit, and they said, "Go walk around in this field and shuffle your feet until you find something, and then mark it, come back, and we'll have UXO people come in and dispose of it." And this is what would happen when we would find one of them, the mushroom cloud in the back. It was like a routine sound. It became so common, we just tune it out. You're like a massive explosion. Like, "Oh, they found something over on the west side." As I said, our equipment hadn't arrived from the States during this time. So I had no job as a mechanic. So what I ended up doing a lot is working on the radio, being the radio operator for this prison camp. And like, so I got to work closely with Iraqi prisoners and be around them a lot. It was kind of at this time that my mind started to change about the occupation, and my feelings about the war really began to solidify, and I began to feel that I had a serious problem being in the military. I had talked to my sergeants about becoming a conscientious objector even before I deployed to Iraq, but I deployed so rapidly I didn't have time to get the paperwork started. When I started meeting the prisoners, then it really became real for me when I met my supposed enemy, and I just had no hatred for them at all. I had pity for them, I had sympathy, and I felt like they were young guys, young soldiers who didn't want to fight, didn't want to kill me any more than I wanted to kill them. And that's when my heart began to change about what I was doing. And I'd like to share my first letter home from Iraq that I wrote from Nasiriya prison camp. I'm writing to you from one of the destroyed and abandoned offices that the military has claimed for its own use. Right now I'm a radio operator for the prisoner of war camp. I use the radio and record anything important that happens. The job is eerily similar to the one I had back at New College as a police dispatcher. I'm sitting here terribly bored and suddenly very lonely. Maybe it's the sight of all these prisoners, ragged, dirty, half-starved, with looks of utter bewilderment and confusion on their faces. I watch them being herded into barbed wire cages, and I can't help but feel terribly sorry for them, no matter who they are or were. Something stirs in me when I see them. They're not being abused or beaten or anything, but I just feel this deep, abiding sorrow for them. They seem so utterly wasted and defeated. The other day, I was told, a 17-year-old boy came in and cried from the moment he was let in till the moment they released him. He was a civilian whose parents and entire family were killed in the war. He'd been walking along with his donkey when I guess he wandered into the wrong place and time. He was arrested and taken to our prison camp. He wept so bitterly because he thought he was being taken to a death camp. One of our chaplains, a Christian who spoke no Arabic, sat down with the boy and comforted him, even cried with him. He was a glimpse of compassion in a generally hard and barren place. I'm too soft for this business. The sight of defeated enemies depresses me and fills me with pity and loathing. Even in this room, there's a strip of flypaper hanging from the window, and on it, a moth is helplessly stuck, its antennae waving feebly. When I look at it, I want to cry. A trapped and dying insect moves me almost to tears, and here I am in this great and victorious war. I'm supposed to be a soldier, some kind of tough guy, and here I am writing about a poor moth. I hate it. I hate seeing any living thing suffer, and the worst thing of all is to be surrounded by pain and unable to do anything. I feel wretched and hypocritical. I can honestly say that I am the worst Buddhist in the world. When we came to Iraq, we knew, even I hadn't read something about Abu Ghraib, but I knew that it was an infamous locale under Saddam Hussein. Some 30,000 Iraqis have been executed there. And we were talking about this in the darkness of Abu Ghraib before we had heat and light. I remember my buddy said, you know there's got to be some ghosts around here. He had just come back from touring the torture and execution chambers at Abu Ghraib. The second quotation comes from my commander, something he said upon our return to the United States. We're all a family here. We don't air our dirty laundry in public, referring to the scandals and misconduct that took place at Abu Ghraib that he didn't want to talk about. This is what Abu Ghraib looked like. This is a section of the main yard and the outer perimeter wall. You might not know, Abu Ghraib is enormous. You might think it's like a U.S. prison, but it's more like a small city, several kilometers on the side. It's an enormous area. And there were, at the time, several thousand, maybe like 5,000 prisoners housed in barbed wire enclosures, and inside there would be tents. The U.S. soldiers watched them from guard towers made from wood stacked on top of shipping Connex crates. The base was under constant mortar bombardment. Every night, 30-something odd shells would fall. Iraqis would be outside the base with a truck and like a little handheld mortar, launch a couple shells, drive somewhere else, launch a couple more. And so they just routinely shell the base. But the military was extremely slow to react to this, so we got shelled every night for like 5 months. It turned out the Army has a system that like a protection shield that allows computers to track where a mortar strikes and allows our artillery to retaliate. Abu Ghraib was on the exact border between two circular air shields, so it was not covered. So we got shelled, and our commander, who was an ex-artillery officer, used to go and tell the command, look, I know how this works, like, we can respond to these attacks, and they would be like, oh, well, you have to file the proper paperwork and stuff. We got shelled like for months and months before anyone did anything. This is what the inside of Abu Ghraib looked like when we got there. It was pretty much choked with debris, metal and stone destroyed, and it was really a miserable place. It was freezing cold, it was dark, because we didn't have any light or heat for the longest time. It took us a couple months before we brought in big 5K generators and set up a camp. This is where most soldiers live. These are two buddies of mine. Most soldiers live inside hard prison buildings, like in cells. All the prisoners were outside, except for a few of intelligence value, and they were kept in something called the hard site, which was kind of like this. And that's where all the Abu Ghraib chicanery took place, inside a building like this on the other side. But all soldiers were housed in prison cells. And there's a lot of talk now bandied about the Geneva Conventions and people throwing allegations, but not too many people have actually read the Geneva Conventions, but I went and made it my business to. Article 22. Prisoners of war interned in unhealthy areas or where the climate is injurious for them shall be removed as soon as possible to a more favorable climate. Of course, that was not done. They were left in the cold, and one of the means of control that the guards exerted on them was if they misbehaved, they'd remove the tent. Then they'd remove their blankets. Then they'd remove their cold weather clothing, leaving them sitting on a platform, freezing in northern Iraq. The Geneva Convention also forbids collective punishment for individual misbehavior. So that was another violation. Article 29. The detaining power shall be bound to take all sanitary measures necessary to ensure the cleanliness and healthfulness of camps and to prevent epidemics. Now, in terms of preventing epidemics, 18 men in my unit came back with tuberculosis, TB positive, from contact with Iraqi prisoners. Because there was so much tuberculosis in Abu Ghraib, it was not even an epidemic, it was more of a pandemic. Almost everyone was infected with tuberculosis, and we're living in such close quarters inside those tents, of course it spread. They had access to military doctors, they could go on sick call in the morning, but there's only a limited amount of US doctors and Iraqi doctors for the 5,000 odd prisoners. Also, for some reason, an enormous amount of Iraqi men had diabetes. So like one third of all the prisoners there had some sort of diabetes. So like I remember I was working in the battalion radio, and like a guy died from like diabetic shock. Like, well, I was on the radio with me, one of the Iraqi detainees, because we couldn't get him out fast enough. People were like dying all the time. A statistic is that only one third of all deaths at Abu Ghraib were from natural causes. So the other two thirds. The majority of prisoners at Abu Ghraib were not there for crimes against the coalition. They were there for petty crimes. I was looking through their rap sheet. Public drunkenness, petty theft, false ID, impersonating a coalition officer. Nonviolent, petty crimes, the vast majority. The 2005 Department of Defense report talks about random prisoner sweep, and I remember the officers in the command were telling me about it. After a mortar attack, they would go and into the city and just pick up everybody between like the age of 17 and maybe 45, all the men of that age, take them into Abu Ghraib for questioning. They'd immediately clear all of them, realizing that they hadn't done anything. But the processing took 6 months to a year in order to get them out of Abu Ghraib. So a lot of people who were completely innocent, who hadn't done any crime, would end up having to stay in Abu Ghraib for 6 months to a year, subject to mortar bombardment, subject to being shot in a riot, subject to rotting food, freezing cold. One of the main incidents that defined Abu Ghraib for me, in late November, the prisoners, they had reached kind of like a boiling point. The camp was very unstable. The prisoners had been demonstrating for several nights against their living conditions, complaining about the cold, complaining about the quantity of food, the type of food. You can read also in the 2005 Department of Defense report about prisoners of Abu Ghraib being served rotting food and being vomiting after meals because the food they served was inedible, because they used local Iraqi contractors at the lowest bidder to feed inmates, and the food was decaying. So they were protesting their living conditions. They were protesting not being allowed to smoke. Also, ironically, a provision of the Geneva Convention. So they had made these homemade banners, and they were marching around, chanting Islamic slogans, and just generally acting unruly. It got unruly. They started picking up like pieces of stone that were in the ground and pieces of tent stakes and throwing them at American soldiers. Some of the guys in my unit were there on guard. One of them got hit in the face, and he got kind of a bloody nose. He had like a bit of a cut on his face. The guards there, I wasn't there because I didn't have a weapon, but I heard it from the people who did it, and also I have photos of the incident, and I'll show you. They tried to quell the disturbance with non-lethal rounds, firing rubber bullets and the shotgun non-lethal slugs and tear gas. They ran out. They requested permission to use lethal force. They got it. They opened fire on the prisoners, shot 15 of them. They killed 3, wounded 12. And I know this because one of the guys who shot the prisoners came and showed me photos, and he was bragging about it. He was like, I shot this guy in the face. He took three rounds in the face, and his head split apart. I'll show you. I shot my guy in the groin. It took him 3 days to bleed to death in the yard of Abu Ghraib. And I was sitting there, and this guy was like a devout Christian. He was like the nicest guy you ever met. I asked him, like, are you really proud of shooting an unarmed man behind barbed wire for throwing a stone? He was like, well, you know, I was just doing my job. I sank down, loaded my weapon, said a prayer, and I got up and I shot all these people. And it was like, there was a total disconnect between, like, just shot a man in the groin and he bled to death in 3 days. And just no expression at all. Like, no. That was what defined Abu Ghraib for me. And then our command took these ghoulish photos and pasted them in our headquarters. Circulated them, and it was like a macho thing. It was like a trophy taking thing. Like, oh, we shot 5 of them and we killed this many, and the photos were in our headquarters. So that was the attitude they had. These are members of my unit removing the bodies of prisoners who were killed in that disturbance that I talked about, where they were shot for throwing stones. It's mentioned in the Taguba report. It's the key word is golden spike. That's the containment protocol for when something's becoming unruly. Basically, these men were shot, gunned down for throwing stones, for protesting their living condition. Their bodies were loaded into a truck. I didn't take these photos, by the way. I wasn't there. These were from a friend of mine who actually was there. I would never allow these kind of photos to be taken. They loaded the bodies for transport to wherever their ultimate destination was. But before transporting them, they, for some reason, part of the thing was to pose and like mutilate the bodies and toy with them. So this is one of the men who was shot in the riot. It's a real guy, it's a young guy, he's dead, not coming back. Killed at Abu Ghraib for throwing stones, protesting his living conditions. It's real. It's not just, you know, a statistic. These guys are dead. This is what it looks like when you take 3 machine gun bullets to the face for protesting your living conditions. Head split apart. A member of my unit smiling and posing with a plastic MRE spoon as he scoops out the previous guy's brains. And this was the atmosphere at Abu Ghraib. This is how U.S. soldiers conducted themselves. Not all soldiers were bad. In fact, most of the guys were decent, tough, trying to do their job. There were men of conscience there. But a significant majority had no respect at all, no sensitivity. And they became so callous and cruel, and it's not surprising because any one of us could become this way. No problem under those conditions. There was the Taguba report talks about Abu Ghraib being undermanned, about a battalion-sized element running 5,000 prisoners, where in other cases a battalion was holding only 500 prisoners. So we were really understaffed. We were under constant bombardment, life or death threat every day. And a lot of people took those conditions and that suffering, and they turned it inward, and it became more spiritual, more compassionate, more caring about other people. But some people took all that stress, and they like imploded, and then they turned it outwards, and they abused the detainees who were under their thumb, and they were cruel and mutilated bodies, and just a way of coping with all this misery of being at Abu Ghraib, which I understand well, because I was there for 6 months. But not everyone was like this. But the people who were there who did this disgraced themselves. They disgraced the army. They disgraced the government. They disgraced us. We may not see this here in the States, but I guarantee you they're seeing images like this in Al Jazeera. I guarantee you they're seeing it in the Middle East. And so we look around and we wonder why they despise us. We say, these ungrateful people, we're doing all these good things for them, and look how they hate us. But that's not what they see. We heard about Abu Ghraib in late December, early January, 2003 to 2004, so months before it came out in America. We heard, mostly what we heard was about sexual abuse. We heard about videotaping detainees and forcing them to masturbate and other sort of like sexual misconduct. And what we heard was that someone in the people who had been doing it had gotten disgruntled and sent the tape to CNN. What we heard about was a videotape and some photos. And immediately after this rumor started circulating among us, we were on the other side of Abu Ghraib, but we knew that unit. Officers, military officers came to us and said, if you have any incriminating photos, destroy them. If you see anything, don't write about it. If you saw anything, don't say anything about it back home. So there was an informal, like, silence. And I remember they said that phrase, we're all a family here. We don't air our dirty laundry in public. Well, keep it quiet. Don't talk about it. So when they tried to say the military didn't know about abuse at Abu Ghraib, it was laughable because officers came to us and told us not to talk about it. So obviously, they knew. This quotation comes from my commander upon returning to the States. He was talking to our whole company because we heard there was going to be some media there to greet us. He was looking at me in particular and he said, now don't go saying anything negative to the media. I brought every one of you back alive. This is not the time to be criticizing the war. And he told us that if we said anything negative about Abu Ghraib, about our unit, we'd be betraying our brothers who were still over there. We would be betraying the soldiers if we said anything or talked about what we saw. Just a little side note, what I want to tell people about is, while I was at Abu Ghraib, I attended the funeral of a young man who was killed by a roadside bomb. He had driven over an anti-tank mine and had sliced his Humvee in half, an armored Humvee, and disintegrated his body. This young guy was 1 week from coming back on home leave. He had come back from his home leave. He had just gotten married. He had a one-year-old son and a newborn son. And he could have stayed home because his newborn son had a brain condition. But he chose to come back because he said, I want to come back to my friends and my buddies. He came back that week. He was bisected by an anti-tank mine. We were at this guy's funeral. We didn't know him that well. He was across the way from us. But there were all these guys, and we were weeping. We were doing everything we could to hold together as he came forward and he did testimony about his life. We talked about his infant son and his widow now. And our commander, the same person who said this, after their unit filed out, he laughed and he said, every one of us is coming back alive. 670th can't say that about the unit that had just lost one of their men. And everyone in the army chapel was just mouths open. Couldn't believe the insensitivity of this man after a funeral to laugh about being able to say, we brought all of our people back and they can't say that. So we had less than no respect for this man. And this is what he told us. That he brought us all back, so we have an obligation not to say anything. Like when I came back from Iraq, I was non-functional for like 6 months. I was like completely depression, but like the worst thing for soldiers, like you want to understand what soldiers are like, this is what they're like. You go from your adrenaline being like here all the time, like constant attack, constant danger, constant excitement. You've got your buddies around you all the time. You live together, you work together, you eat together. And then you come home and suddenly your buddies are gone. You have no friends around you. Your excitement level's down here and like you don't want to get up and go to work and go to school and go eat breakfast. And I used to be in bed and I was like, why would I get up? There was nothing going on. It was like so, life was so empty and like boring and flat. And that's the worst thing. More than a depression, just the loss of like excitement. Like, well, we were in Iraq, we felt like we were part of history, you know, like we were on the cusp of history. Then we come back to our normal lives and we're just, you know, students and Burger King workers and whatever other like petty jobs we had, and like suddenly we don't have any purpose. So that becomes depression. And all the guys, you know, I call them all the time, we're always like checking in on each other and we're like, are you okay, man? You know, and most of the guys are suicidal or antisocial, where they want to go back to Iraq because they can't handle being a nobody anymore. Like,
coming home, and like all y'all are so nice, and you're all like talking to me and listening to me. But, like, when I came back from Iraq, I was a nobody, and nobody understood. You can't talk with civilians about it because they weren't there. You can only talk with the guys in your unit who saw it, and you can only communicate with them. So you feel totally disconnected. Like, my girlfriend, she wanted to support me. She wanted to, like, be there for me, but she couldn't, because she could never understand. And that feeling of isolation, of not having your boys around you, like, when you woke up in the morning, they were right there. And when you ate, they were right there, and now they're gone. And that was, like, so hard. And it took me, like, 6 months to put all this, like, behind me, like, find it, like, get it in the back burner.
So by way of conclusion, even though Abu Ghraib was a miserable experience for me, horrible time in my life, I had a lot of good times while I was there too. I formed incredibly close friendships with the guys in my unit who stood by me while everybody else betrayed me. We used to watch movies when we finally got power. We used to sit around and joke, and I had a lot of good times. And sometimes I even feel crazily like I wish I could go back, because I wish I had all those friends around me all the time and so much energy and excitement and adrenaline being there all the time. But at other times, Abu Ghraib was a very dark, horrible place. It had been a miserable place under Saddam, and we made it even more infamous by our actions. And what I saw at Abu Ghraib and what I witnessed, and when I met the enemy and the enemy was us, when I saw brutality, not from my opponents, but from my own fellow soldiers, I'll take that with me the rest of my life. And I'll never forget all the ugliness I saw at Abu Ghraib. The ugliness of the coalition, the ugliness of the occupation, that we don't feel like we own. We only own democracy. We only own opening schools. We don't feel like we own Abu Ghraib, and that we as an American people are responsible for the civilians that died, for the abuse, for the misconduct.
My personal opinion is that the conditions do not exist to make it possible to have a free election. The fact that their country is occupied by the armed force of another nation renders it a paradox to even have a free election. The violence when I was there was so bad that you couldn't walk down the street safely. It's only gotten worse since I left. So the possibility of holding a free election is just ludicrous. And there's been no indication that it will be positive. And I really hope it is. Like, I hope they have a free democracy. But I'm not optimistic about it at all.
I guess just to close it, I'd like to finish the quotation from Chekhov that appeared at the beginning of this presentation. We do not see or hear those who suffer, and what is terrible in life goes on somewhere behind the scenes. Everything is peaceful and quiet, and only mute statistics protest. The happy man is at ease, only because the unhappy ones bear their burdens in silence. And if there were not this silence, happiness would be impossible. There ought to be someone reminding him that there are unhappy people, and that life will sooner or later show him its claws, and trouble will come to him, and then no one will see or hear him. Just as now, he neither sees nor hears others.